session number 21729, Wheel 2.
Mr. Brent Cotton, Wheel 2.
We were on a boat, I think it was one of the old Isle of Man boats, Manxman or Lady of Man or something like that, one of those. And we landed at Ostend. I remember standing on the street corner at Ostend with a pal of mine who I'd met up with. I didn't know him before I went in the army, but he came from Mansfield, not far from where I lived. And we were standing on a street corner, and another soldier came up to us and said, "Could you tell me where the nearest fish and chip shop is?" Now, this was in wartime Ostend. This pal of mine, Ron Godber, pointed out to sea and he said, "Dover." And the lad thought we were taking the mickey. He actually thought he was going to find a fish and chip shop in Ostend in 1944. We were in that camp for, I don't know, a couple of days maybe, and then we were on a train. And we went to Burg Leopold. I think over there they call it Leopoldsburg, which is in Belgium, which was a big transit camp. And there were no Sherwood Forester battalion. We were both Sherwood Foresters, along with about eight others who were also Sherwood Foresters. And there was no Sherwood Forester battalion at all in Northwest Europe in the Second Army. They were in Italy. They were in the Far East. And so we were posted to the 4th Battalion Dorsets. We arrived at the 4th Dorsets, D Company. Ron Godber and I went to D, well, I think we all of us went to D Company of the 4th Dorsets. That battalion, the 4th Dorsets, had been the only battalion in 30 Corps of the 2nd Army that actually got over the river at Arnhem to try and relieve the Paras, and had taken an awful lot of casualties in doing so, and needed reinforcements. And we, eight Sherwood Foresters, were part of the reinforcements that were sent to them. They lost about 300 people at Arnhem. So we joined D Company of the 4th Dorsets late on a Friday afternoon, and the platoon commander said, "Welcome aboard, you're just in time, we're going into the attack on Sunday morning." So, that was a welcome.
Can you recall your feelings at the time?
I can recall very vividly something had happened on the night before. We joined them on Friday, late Friday afternoon, and we moved up on Saturday to somewhere fairly close behind the actual front line, close enough to hear gunfire, and we dug in a little copse, and I remember the corporal, the section commander, saying, "You don't need to dig very deep because, you know, there's no problem here and we're only here for the night." And we dug shallow foxholes. And Ron Godber and myself were put on guard from 2 till 4, I think it was. And at 4 o'clock, we got to wake the rest of the platoon. I mean, that illustrates it wasn't a very unsafe position, because two raw recruits, as it were given the guard job, you know, on the first night. So we were in no real danger there, as far as we could see, unless somebody lobbed a real big shell over. And Ron Godber and I had got to wake up the rest of the platoon at 4 o'clock. We were going to have something to eat and then move in. So we were on the edge of this copse, and Ron said, "I'll go and wake this lot here and you go that way, you know." So like a fool, I stuck my rifle up against a tree and went off to where these foxholes were to wake people up. And I'd gone about, I don't know, 10, maybe 20 yards, and I saw this fella standing there. And I knew, I'd seen German soldiers in POW camps on the way up from Ostend, and I could see in the dark, clearly this guy was a German. And I had no rifle. There I was, an 18-year-old kid, in the middle of the night, in the middle of a wood, and just over the German border, with a German soldier standing, and I just froze. I didn't know what to do. There was nothing I could do that I could think of. I don't know how long I stood there.
Did he move?
No. And I thought, what's he doing here? Is he on his own? Is he part of a patrol? If I walk away and pretend I haven't seen him, if I do that, he'd liable to shoot me in the back or whatever. And I just stood there, rigid. And I don't know how long for. But then I heard Ron Godber coming from my left-hand side. And as Ron got near, he saw me standing there and he said, "You all right, Frank?" And I said, I probably croaked, "See that?" And he said, "Yeah, it's a great coat hanging on that tree." And it was. But in I suppose, without realising it, we were all keyed up. And this, it looked like an outline of a man standing there. And for some reason, it appeared to me to be a German, you know. Anyway, it was a great coat hanging on a tree. So, having woken up the platoon and all the rest of the platoon in the company had been awake by then, we had something to eat and eventually moved off to what's known in military jargon as the start line. We were... The job was to capture a wood. The main body was the 5th Battalion Dorset, so we're in the same brigade as us, and D Company of the 4th Dorset's in support, so we're operating with a different battalion to the one we would have been most of the time. And we captured the wood during the day at some cost. In fact, the divisional commander is on record of saying that henceforth that wood will be known as Dorset Wood, and it's still in the history of the Dorset Regiment. It's still, you know, one of their not battle honours, but it's frequently mentioned, or, you know, whenever the history of the Dorsets is talked about. And then the 5th Battalion withdrew and the rest of the 4th came in, and we took up defensive positions in that wood for about the next 10 days. And it was pretty awful. The weather was vile. It rained and rained and rained. The tracks in the wood actually did look like the sort of things you see in old pictures and films of World War I. That's how wet and muddy and awful it was. And we were getting shelled by everything from small mortars a couple of fields away to big guns from the Siegfried line, because this wood actually was near, not very far from a place called Garlandkirchen, which was almost part of the Siegfried line. And we were in there for about 10 days. I had an experience there too. At the end of the first day, the platoon runner must have been killed or wounded, because they needed another platoon runner, and the platoon commander said to me, you better do it. I was brand new, I didn't have any more sense than, you know, argue with him. Each platoon had a platoon runner who stayed with the company headquarters, which was a little bit further back in the wood, not very far, maybe 50 yards, and the platoons were on the perimeter of the wood facing the enemy, as it were. And every time the company commander would tell me to go to this platoon or that platoon, you know, with a message, and sometimes I had to bring one back or whatever. And every time I went out of my foxhole to one of the platoons, the geography had changed. You know, the little bush that used to be there is now at the top of that tree over there. And where that big slender tree stood is now just a stump that's broken off 3 foot up in the air, you know. So it was not easy to always to find the platoon and find your way back. And one night he sent me off there to my own platoon, 10th platoon, and I got lost coming back. I must have gone, instead of coming back to company headquarters, I must have come at a different angle and missed them somehow. decided to go back and start again, and probably went on a different angle again, did that about three. In the end, I was hopelessly lost. I was in the middle of this wood, and there was shelling going on from time to time. The Germans used to lob them over, just to keep you on your toes. And I thought, this is hopeless. I'm going to walk into trouble if I'm not careful. Either walk into a German patrol or the German lines or whatever. And as I say, I was pretty new to this game. I really didn't know what day it was. So I hopped into a big shell hole and decided that I would stay there until daylight came. And I'd been in there about half an hour or so, I suppose. And I heard footsteps coming. And I could see through the trees and the sky beyond, I could see head and shoulders, you know. And I could tell by the shape of the helmets that they were British. So, like a fool, I got up and ran towards them, and there was rifle bolts going. And steady, you know, I'm British. And it was the quartermaster sergeant, company quartermaster sergeant, with the cooks bringing up the breakfast. And I didn't even know they were. I was so new to the company, you know. And this CQMS says, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm looking for D Company." "Get in behind us," he said. "I'm going up to company headquarters." And I went in with them and got back to company headquarters. And I popped my head in the company commander's foxhole and said, "Deliver that message." And it must have been at least an hour and a half after he gave it me. And he never commented where you've been, what you've been doing, you know.
Do you think you were very far off course?
Probably not. But on a wet night, a dark night, in the middle of a wood, it's very, very easy to get lost in daylight if the wood's thick enough, never mind in. No. Oh, in fact, when I tagged down behind the cooks, I don't suppose we went more than about maybe 200 yards, and we were at company headquarters. Yeah.
Where did you go from?
This was in around about February of 1945. We did all sorts of things in between time. We were down near the Ardennes, time of the Battle of the Bulge. We weren't thrown into the battle, but Montgomery had our division, probably other divisions too, in a blocking position behind the River Meuse in case the Americans didn't hold. And we spent Christmas Day on 2 hours' notice to move in case the Americans didn't hold the line, as it were. However, we weren't called on, and shortly after that we were taken off this notice and we moved, I don't know, somewhere else. We were mostly around the Dutch-German border during that winter.
Were you told very much about what was going on? Well, did you know?
I was fortunate in some ways because having been lumbered with this job as a runner, which I didn't like very much, and I wanted to go back to the platoon, and the company commander wouldn't let me, because you spend a lot of time on your own. I mean, it's like I did in that wood on the first occasion. And you never know, you could get wounded by a shell or a bullet or whatever, and especially in wooded country, nobody knows. You know, you're just lying there. You would do, and I mean, you could lie there and bleed to death, as it were. So I wasn't very much in love with this job, but one advantage in it was that the company commander almost invariably had aerial photographs of whatever we were going to, the areas we were going to, what we were going to do, you know, where the village you're going to attack. And so I had a pretty good chance, a pretty good idea of what we were about. Also, of course, he had the signalers there, and so all the messages that were coming in and going out, you would hear. So I probably had as with the other platoon runners, because there were three of us, one from each platoon there, probably had more idea of what was going on than the lads actually in the platoon who were just, I mean, the officer would go to what we call an O group, an orders group, and he would go back and tell the lads what to do. But I think we probably had more of an insight in what we were up to, those of us in this small company headquarters, than the ordinary lad in the section or the platoon.
When did you move on from?
We moved. We were knocking about that area near where Dorset Wood was, near Garlandkirchen, and that area most of that winter. It was what was called the Ruhr Salient, the Ruhr River, not the Ruhr area, the Ruhr. We were working alongside the American Ninth Army at that time, and then at the end of that winter, we moved up towards Nijmegen. And it was from Nijmegen that we kicked off on the operation to clear the Reichswald Forest and reach up to the Rhine, around about February of 1945.
Would you just like to take it from there?
Well, we left Nijmegen. There were other divisions involved in clearing the Reichswald Forest too. The 53rd Welsh, we were the 43rd Wessex Div, the 51st Highland Div, the 53rd Welsh, and maybe others too, I don't remember. We kicked off from Nijmegen and we moved along the northern edge of the Reichswald Forest and then headed south down the eastern side of it. Some of the divisions actually went into the Reichswald itself. We were operating down what the military people called the Hochwald Layback. The Siegfried Line at that point actually sort of bent over like that, as sort of hook, and we were in the middle of it. So we didn't fight our way through the Siegfried Line, fought our way down the middle of it almost. And we came down the eastern edge of the Reichswald Forest onto an escarpment overlooking the town of Gok, which had been heavily bombed. There were two towns in that area, Cleve and Gok, heavily bombed by the Air Force, British, American, probably both, and onto the Gok escarpment, where we had quite a scrap with a German para unit. By this time, the Germans never used, after Crete, the Germans never used paras as paras, but they used them as infantry, and they were very good infantry too, as you can imagine, being paratroopers. They were a tough lot. And we had quite a scrap with them on the Gok escarpment, and we lost quite a few lads there.
What was your experience there?
Mostly, the Germans had dug a lot of what I suppose you might call communication trenches, very deep, very wide, and you could actually move along them almost standing up, they were so deep. They weren't intended, I don't think, to fight from. They were probably intended to help stop tanks and for communications. I remember mostly moving around those trenches, probably carrying messages. I remember me and another fellow on one occasion, they often dug the trenches sort of zigzag. And I think the reason for that was that if a shell landed, the blast didn't go right along the trench, you know, it because of the zigzag. And I remember being in one of those trenches one day with another fellow, can't remember what we were doing, what we were supposed to be doing, and a shell landed no further from us than that wall, a couple of yards. But there was the zigzag, so although we felt the blast and the percussion, we weren't actually hurt. Shook us up a little bit, realising one had landed so close. On another occasion, after we had captured the Gok escarpment, we had a platoon out on a standing patrol in, I think it was outside of the Reichswald, in a bit that was known as Cleve Forest, and the which was quite a distance away, some hundreds of yards away, and the company commander told the runner from that platoon to take some message, and I could see he was a bit apprehensive. His name was Jefford, and I said, "Okay, Jeff, I'll come with you," which was a silly thing to do. You're taught very early on in the army, or you learn very early on, never volunteer for anything. But anyway, we set off in one of these long communication trenches towards this wood where the platoon were, and at one point the trench stopped because there was a fairly wide track. Maybe they'd left it for the farm vehicles or military vehicles, I don't know, but at that point you had to get out of the trench, go over the track into the trench the other side and carry on. And as we ambled over this track to go down the trench at the other side, all of a sudden there was a burst of Spandau just behind us. So we dived down into the trench the other side and we went up, we delivered the message, and when we came back we said, "We've got to watch it here, you know. They've obviously got a Spandau lined up on this spot." So we kept well down so that nobody could see us approaching this track, and then when we got there we went like hell over it and the other side, before anybody could fire or anything. What we had overlooked though, the Germans used to have small now 2-inch mortars on a square base plate about as big as that piece of paper, quite a small bomb, and they started lobbing those over, and as we were scuttling along this trench there was about 3 of them dropped. Fortunately none of them dropped in the trench, so we were okay. But I said when we got back, "That's the last time I ever volunteered to go anywhere with you, Jeff, you know, you're unlucky." And then we moved from there. By that time the ground was clear right up to the Rhine, and there was a build up taking place ready for the Rhine crossing, and we moved up to a place opposite the German town of Emmerich, and it was all flooded. The Germans, I suppose as a defensive measure, had burst the banks of the Rhine and flooded this area. It was about, I don't know, it must have been about 2 miles of water. We actually had to go up to these positions, which was in a village, I can't remember the name of it, in amphibious vehicles. That's how much water there was. And it was rather eerie position. In front of us was the Rhine. Behind us was about a mile of flood water, and we were on ground that was slightly higher, which is why it wasn't flooded. And there was all sorts of rumours about German patrols coming over the Rhine. I don't know if they actually did, but this was generally believed at the time that this was happening. And for some reason, around about that time, we had a system of passwords. We hadn't used it before. We hadn't used them before. And the first password word we had was Easter Bonnet. And because the company commander had told us about the password, Easter Bonnet, he got himself the nickname of Easter Bonnet, which was fairly apt in some ways, because he was a nice guy. He was a bit of a bumbler, you know, not an officer you had complete confidence in. So, and the other thing was that for some reason that I never understood, people could not seem to grasp how to use the password. If the password was Easter Bonnet, I mean, if you're challenging someone, you say, "Give the password," and he said Easter, you reply Bonnet. But they used to, and everybody's happy, but they used to say, "Halt Easter." Well, you know, you can have a guess, Bonnet, Egg, Monday, or, you know, or a password like, say, Aston Villa. If someone says Aston, there's only one answer going to, you know, it has to be Villa. And I never know who introduced this particular password, but it, on one occasion it was Stupid Stenographer. Now, yeah, you may look like that. Most people didn't know what a stenographer was. Half the guys couldn't even say it. And we were in this position opposite Emmerich, And in the middle of the night, the company commander wanted to go along to visit one of the platoons, and he said, "You've got him, you come with me." And I thought, oh yeah. He don't mind sending me out on in the middle of the night to visit these platoons on my own, but you know, he's got to have someone with him. So off we went, and as we reached number 12 platoon area, and they were in a bombed out house with foxholes around, you know, that where they dug in for sentries to be in and if necessary to fight from. And as we reached the first of these foxholes, where I knew from previous visits there should be at least one man in there, there was no one in there. So I thought, oh, this is a bit odd. So we moved towards the house rather cautiously. And as we reached the door of the house, out of the shadow stepped a figure, rifle and bayonet thrust out, about an inch from the company commander's throat. And a voice that I recognised very well said, "Halt, stupid." Now, this voice came from a fellow called Mitchell, who was an old soldier, India pre-war, been in the army years, and if anyone knew how to use a password, Mitchell did. He knew how to use it correctly, so I figured he was trying to make a point when he challenged the company commander. Well, after we left that area, we moved back a little bit, and all the preparations were then being made for for the Rhine crossing. And we went over the Rhine, I think on the night of the 23rd of March, or thereabouts. We were not assault troops. We went over 43rd Div behind the 51st Highland Div. In fact, the 4th Dorsets went over behind the Black Watch. Although the Black Watch, I was told, had only suffered 4 casualties in the operation, and the trouble really started after we got over the other side. And our first job was to capture a small town, well, it was a village really, called Millingham, which the Canadians had been trying to take all day, and it was being held by, we were told, the German 6th Para. So it was a fairly tough crowd. We took the place in about 2 hours or so, and so I think the Canadians had softened it up for us pretty well. It wasn't that we were better than them. We were the sort of blucher to the Canadian Wellington, I think, or is it the other way around? I can't remember. Anyway, we took this village, and there was about 6 Germans, POWs, who'd been captured, and they brought him into the cellar where the company commander had set up his command post. And we were searching these Germans to make sure they had no arms. And as we searched each one, we passed him along. And the last one was a little chap who was obviously terrified, and he was being passed on, and he couldn't get it out fast enough. He got a knife down the leg of his trousers, and he pulled this knife out, and it was a wicked looking thing, a kind of flick knife with a pig sticker at one end and a blade at the other, and the rest of these Germans were all glowering at him, obviously not very happy about this. So the guys who'd searched them checked them over again, and of course they'd all got knives, which they hadn't revealed or given up. Now, maybe it was just that they wanted to hang on to them, but the tendency in those days, when you captured prisoners, you sent them back under escort with what we used to call the walking wounded. So some guy who got a flesh wound or not too serious would escort these prisoners back. Now, it may be there would have been no problem. But on the other hand, there were 6 tough, well, 5 tough guys in the platoon dope, all armed with knives, and one wounded man in charge of them. And the best time to escape is very shortly after you're captured. You know the area, you know the territory, and it's quite likely that armed with knives.